So we're really excited about tonight. This is, before I introduce this wonderful, lovely woman, let me just tell you about this a little bit. So this is our third Impact training. We've had some really fun, good, great success with trying this. The first two we had, one was on homelessness, and one was on racial and education equity. And they both were really great. And so this is our third one now. And it is, as you know, on combating sex trafficking. And so we're going to have more of these as we go. We're looking at one every quarter. I don't have like a big like, hey, the next one is such and such. So we don't know what that is, but keep an eye out. We will be communicating that. And it will be something good as well to come here and to learn and to just glean from people who have been called by God to be really involved in some of these areas and some of these issues and some of these great causes. And so before, again, yet again, one more thing before I introduce this lovely woman, I want us to pray. Would you do that with me? So God, we just come before you. We're here. We're seated. We come out of the rain. We come in to be warm, but more and more so just to really be present with you, to learn, to be in community together, to hear from you, to hear from others who you have called to do things that maybe some of us aren't doing, and just to be open, to be sponges, and to be called as well out of our seat to maybe engage in some shape, form, or manner. And we trust that you will bring that to us, to our understanding and to our knowledge, and that we will be different tonight because of you calling us here, because of something we're going to learn, because of something we're going to find out about, something that might even change what we do next. I pray that we hear stories and hear these different things from Kayla and what might be statistics and realize these are not numbers. These are people. These are women. These are amazing humans that you've made, you've designed, and you love. And may we, through listening well, love them well. We thank you for this time. We give it to you. In Jesus' name, amen. So this is Kayla Dubois. It's a great name, right? Kayla Dubois, and she is one of the directors of Every Daughter. She will explain her title more and her experience and all that. Can we give her a hand?
Great. Well, welcome, everyone, and thank you for coming. I'm so glad that each and every one of you are here, and we're really just grateful for the opportunity for this space to talk about this issue tonight, and grateful for all of your interest in coming out and learning more about the reality that is sex trafficking in Dane County and how you might participate and join us in loving these vulnerable women in our community. So as Susan mentioned, my name's Kayla Dubois. I'm one of the directors of Every Daughter, and we are a local nonprofit, and essentially we are a group of women from several different churches, including Blackhawk, around the Madison area that do outreach. So we reach out to and provide support to women who are exploited through the commercial sex industry. So that includes women in sex trafficking and prostitution. And it's also important to know my full-time job, I work as a social worker in Child Protective Services. So I've been doing that for the past 9 years. So as I speak tonight, I'm really bringing the perspectives of both kind of the faith-based nonprofit work that we do with Every Daughter, which is primarily with adult women, but also some juveniles, and then also my professional government work on behalf of children, which includes addressing youth sex trafficking. So I'm going to share more about Every Daughter a little bit later on. We're going to have plenty of time for you guys to ask questions, and then we'll actually have you hear from one of our Blackhawk volunteers about their experiences with Every Daughter. But first, I just wanted to give some overview of some really important concepts to understand when it comes to sex trafficking and what this actually looks like in Madison. One other note before I jump in is that you'll probably hear me typically refer to the exploited person as a she, so a woman or a girl, but it's really important to make note that sex trafficking occurs across the full range of gender identity and sexual orientation. At Every Daughter, we work with women and girls, and so that's where most of our experience lies, and that's kind of the language that I'll be using, but just wanted to make a note of that. And I was going to give a PG-13 warning, but everyone here seems to be an adult, so that's good. So there are a lot of myths and misconceptions about sex trafficking. When a lot of people hear the term trafficking, sometimes there's like pictures that come to mind, like someone who's held captive and was taken away from their home and moved to a different country or a different state for what they picture is kind of sex slavery, that they're physically held in bondage. Or some people think of people being kind of kidnapped off the street or from the mall by like a sketchy looking guy in a van and you're like locked up in a basement or something. So these are kind of common images and things that people think of. And it's not that those things couldn't happen or don't happen, but that's just not typically what trafficking looks like. So I wanted to just give a little more of a realistic picture. So this is kind of a case scenario that weaves in a lot of different dynamics that are typical for sex trafficking. So we have a teenage girl who meets someone online, maybe a cute older guy who shows a lot of interest in her, and he's complimenting her and telling her how beautiful she is, and the attention feels great. And they're talking more, and soon they decide to meet up in person, and he sweeps her off her feet, and they start dating and talking about their future together, and he seems like the greatest guy. He's cute, friendly, charismatic, he dresses well, he has a nice car, he has really nice things, he seems successful. And she may even introduce him to her parents or her friends. And one night, he might take her to a party with his older, cool friends, or maybe they even find a way to go away for the weekend together. Maybe she even lies to her parents and about where she is. Maybe she says she's on a camping trip with friends or something. And while they're away together at a party or a weekend away, he's paying for everything. So their food, a hotel, maybe they're partying and drinking, maybe they're experimenting with drugs. And eventually he tells her that she needs to help pay for the weekend. He's put up all this money, bought her all these nice things, and she needs to contribute. And it's going to be really quick and simple, but she just needs to give oral sex to one of his friends. And he's going to pay them $100, and it's just going to be so quick, it's really not even a big deal. And the boyfriend promises that he loves her, and it's only going to be this one time. And she might even say, no, I'm not comfortable with that. I didn't sign up for this. I want to go home. And maybe he kind of sweet talks her and eventually convinces her to do it. Or maybe if that's not working, he says, you know, if you don't do this, I'm going to tell your parents where you were this weekend, and they're going to be so mad at you, and you're going to get in a ton of trouble. And so eventually she agrees to do that. And maybe while she's having sex with his friend, he takes pictures of it. And next time this happens and she refuses, he threatens to post the pictures online, and distribute them at her school, send them to all her friends, and everyone is going to know that she's a slut. So this is one way that sex trafficking can be introduced. They're still dating. She still thinks that he's her boyfriend. And it's really confusing because they still have a lot of fun together. They have a lot of good times. But she is still deeply entangled and drawn to his attention and his affection and promises. And yet the coercion and the manipulation continues and gets stronger. And before you know it, this might be something that's happening every weekend, where he is selling her for sex. And her friends and family might not even know about it. They may end up leaving together. So her friends and family may think that she's run away, or they may know that she's with this guy. She may even keep in contact with her friends and family and say, hey, we moved away to Colorado. I just wanted to be with him. I'm fine. And this could become a constant reality of her having sex for money. And maybe she starts using drugs to numb herself because that's the only way to get through the nights of having sex with 10 or 15 different men. Or maybe her boyfriend, who is selling her, is the one who introduces the drugs to her as a way to control her, because now she's physically addicted and he now has additional power to withhold or give her the drugs that like feel like survival at this point to her. This person we're talking about, this girl, she very well might be only 15 or 16 years old, but look like an adult. Maybe she looks like she could be a college student. And it's very likely that he is advertising her, or she is forced to advertise herself as an adult. And adult men are purchasing her for sex. And those buyers, they might believe and view her as an adult prostitute who is doing this voluntarily as a free choice and have no idea the reality of what's going on. Or very possibly, they know that she's underage and they don't care. In fact, very likely, she's in much higher demand because of her young age. So that is what sex trafficking looks like. Out in the real world, sex trafficking looks like prostitution. And there are a lot of different ways that people can get into sex trafficking situations. It could be that kind of boyfriend scenario that I described that's really common. Or traffickers can just use kind of brutal force and threats of violence to control their victims. We know that children are sometimes trafficked by their own family members, including their own parents or people who are close to their family. And then there's always situations where people are trafficked by gang members or drug dealers or guys they meet working at a strip club. So there's just kind of a lot of different scenarios that can lead to sex trafficking. Every person's experience is different, and you'll hear that when you listen to survivors. And there are also a lot of common themes that we can learn from when it comes to the vulnerabilities of those who are trafficked, and in particular, the psychological control that they experience, which keeps them in these situations. So let's just take a step back for a minute and cover some basic definitions. So sex trafficking is defined differently for kids and adults, and we're going to talk about both of those tonight. So it's important to know what this issue looks like for youth for a couple different reasons. One is that for many survivors, abuse and exploitation began when they were children. So understanding this dynamic is really important also to how we perceive the issue for adults. And secondly, youth trafficking is a big part of what trafficking actually consists of in Madison. So we work really closely with Madison detective Roger Baker. He's with the Madison PD, and he specializes in youth trafficking. And he says that in Dane County, in Madison, the typical age of entry that they're seeing for kids is age 14 to 15. So it's very much a reality in our community. And so understanding it for both lenses is important. So definition-wise for children, this is really straightforward. So any participation in commercial sexual activity, and by that I mean sex in exchange for anything of value, so that could be money, food, clothing, shelter, drugs, anything, is considered sex trafficking. So any participation, any sex in exchange for anything of value is sex trafficking when you're talking about someone under 18. So you don't need to prove that the child was forced to do it or that it was non-consensual. If it happened, no matter what the circumstances were, it's called sex trafficking. And what sex trafficking really is at its core is an exploitation of vulnerability. So where we most often see trafficking occurring with youth is where there are these kind of extra layers of vulnerability. And I wanted to name some of the most significant ones for you. So first is homeless or runaway youth. So for kids who are on the run or don't have a home or a place of safety, they're very easily identified as targets by traffickers and those looking to exploit them. There's a term that we use called survival sex, and that's participating in sexual activity in exchange for basic needs. So for shelter, for a place to stay for the night, for a meal or food or clothing. And that, again, as a child, is considered sex trafficking. The next big area of vulnerability for youth is those who are involved in the child welfare system. So these are the kids that I work with at my day job every day. So those who have a history of abuse and neglect and are not living with their families. So they're in foster care, they're in group homes, they're living in some other sort of out of home placement. And they're particularly vulnerable because, again, they have some sort of abuse and neglect in their family history. there's some level, at least, of family dysfunction, and they're more likely to run away from a bad situation that's happening at home, or if they're in kind of a foster home or a group home placement that they don't want to be in. For traffickers that are specifically looking for people to exploit, they know very well that there's a lot of issues going on for youth who are in foster homes or group homes. I've even heard, this is a couple years ago, but a local training, that they had heard that there were actually traffickers kind of camped out down the street from group homes or youth shelters because they know that there are vulnerable kids staying there. So when they run away or leave, they can kind of easily identify who those kids are. Or it might be that someone who's looking to exploit a child is kind of interacting with different teens online. And when you have a kid who shares that they're in a group home or that they, you know, make some comment about hating their parents or their foster parents, that's just a kind of a quick indication that there's a lot of vulnerability in that child's life. Next is LGBTQ youth. So LGBTQ youth are definitely at a heightened vulnerability, and that they're not especially vulnerable because of their sexual orientation or gender identity, but it's because they're more often rejected from their families and kicked out and then become homeless. Also, youth with a history of sexual abuse or mental health concerns are at significant risk, as well as youth who, for whatever reason, are looking for love and acceptance, which, if you know teenagers, is a lot of them. particularly those with kind of low self-worth or self-esteem and have poor boundaries, again, is just those areas of vulnerability that people looking to exploit know that they can go in and kind of start that manipulation. So if you're interested in more details about child sex trafficking, there's a handout that was on the table over there that you can grab, or maybe you already have, called Child Sex Trafficking. And this is actually comes from part of a policy that I wrote as part of my day job. And this just really goes through like the legal definition. It goes through some more examples. And then this is a really comprehensive list of indicators of child sex trafficking, so different behavioral and physical indicators. So this is handy to keep for reference. And then I also included on the back information on reporting child sex trafficking. So any of you in the room, are any of you mandated reporters? Yeah, okay. So you have jobs where you know you're a mandated reporter. So not everyone knows, but recently, like in the past couple of years, child sex trafficking is now officially legally a form of child sexual abuse. So for those of you that are mandated reporters, if you see signs or you're concerned about sex trafficking, you're required as a mandated reporter to report to CPS or law enforcement. So, and then there's a link to kind of the official indicator and response guide for the state, as well as information about the National Human Trafficking Hotline. So that's all in this handout if you want more, since we can't go into everything tonight. All right, so many of the dynamics of sex trafficking are similar for youth and adults, but the law does view them differently, obviously. So to be defined as sex trafficking for an adult, you need to prove that the exploitation occurred through one of three things: force, fraud, or coercion. So it's only sex trafficking if the sexual exploitation was through force, fraud, or coercion. So along with that kind of legal difference is a difference in how we as a society view this issue and the people involved when it comes to kids and adults. So obviously most people recognize that the exploitation of children is wrong. Children having sex for money is wrong. No matter what, even if the child's saying they want to do it and they agree to it, most people recognize that's not okay. Most people also recognize that kids or adults that are actually being forced into having sex for money is also wrong. But then you get into this territory of adults who have sex for money who do not meet that sex trafficking definition of force, fraud, and coercion. And then people start viewing that differently. So this is an adult who is consenting to this and they're willing participants. So this is classic prostitution. And typically there is just tons of stigma and judgment and stereotypes and jokes and just kind of a total lack of compassion. But what people fail to realize is that adults who are choosing prostitution are often the youth who were exploited as kids. They've just gotten older. So you have a teenager who started being trafficked at age 13 and 14. This continues throughout their teenage years, maybe on and off. Maybe they're under the control of a trafficker and maybe not, but it's all considered sex trafficking under 18. And then the day they turn 18, they become an adult, and the way that we view them changes, both legally and, you know, culturally. And now this becomes a choice that they make. They're responsible for it. They're willing participants. This is a consensual adult act. This is prostitution. Or that adult may not have actually been trafficked as a child. Maybe they avoided that reality, but they still have and carry into adulthood all of those same vulnerabilities that lead to exploitation. So prostitution, like sex trafficking, is also the result of vulnerability. So the same things that make kids vulnerable to trafficking make adults vulnerable to feeling like prostitution is their only choice. So poverty, homelessness, substance dependence, mental health concerns, history of abuse and neglect. So when you see and hear the reality that prostituted women face, when you actually get to know people and you hear their stories and why they're in the place that they're in, you realize that the concept of choice is actually very complicated, and that prostitution is most often a reality for people that feel that they have no other choice. So it's really important to understand that when we use the term sexual exploitation, we're referring to both sex trafficking and prostitution. So at Every Daughter, we do not make a distinction between the two when it comes to the women that we serve. And this is actually true of all the other local organizations we know that work with exploited women. So sex trafficking and prostitution are not the same thing, but we realize that the line between them is really fuzzy. They often overlap and intersect, and we realize that all of it is exploitation. All of it is the degradation of human beings as the result of really complex systems of vulnerability and powerlessness. So there's that important concept to understand. I did just want to elaborate a little bit more too on psychological control. So when it comes to trafficking situations, it's often difficult for people to understand why the person being trafficked, if they're not being kind of physically held, why don't they just leave? What's keeping them there? And this is a really complex question that we don't quite have time to get into all the details on. But I do want to highlight the concept of psychological control, because this is primarily what keeps people in these relationships. So there's actually a lot of similarity between sex trafficking and domestic violence. Both of which can include physical abuse and violence and typically have an element of really strong psychological control. So there are two other handouts that were over there that I want to point you to for a little more reading and reference on your part. So the first is this one. So this is the power and control wheel, and this is a tool that helps describe the different ways that partners can use power and control to manipulate others in a relationship. This was originally developed to describe domestic violence, and this tool has since been adapted to describe a lot of different phenomenon. And this copy that I gave you guys is the human trafficking version of it. So this was adapted by Polaris Project. I'm not going to go through it in a ton of detail, but you can see that it describes the different elements of power and control, the different types of tactics that are used, as well as specific examples of how this plays out in trafficking situations specifically. And this covers both sex trafficking and labor trafficking. So just handy for you to have and read later. And then the other one that I brought for you guys is this one called Why She Doesn't Leave, The Power of Coercion. So this handout was developed by the Rebecca Bender Initiative a while back. Rebecca is a sex trafficking survivor who's now an author and a speaker. And this document gives a lot of specific examples of how traffickers and abusive partners use coercion with their victims. So this was based on real accounts of survivors and their experiences. So I would encourage you to sign your own time to kind of read through this. Both these handouts, and just get more of a glimpse into what psychological control looks like in relationships, and will kind of help you understand the complexities of why it's not so easy for people to leave these situations. So moving on, you may be wondering, how does this actually work? Like logistically, how are people bought and sold in Madison? And I wanted to just give a few examples of the ways that this can happen. So One is at strip clubs. So strip clubs are an environment where people can end up, you know, connecting for paid sex. So sometimes trafficking victims are recruited to work as hostesses, servers, dancers, and then made to have sex with customers for money. Another is massage parlors. So there's a number of massage parlors in our area. And in general, massage parlors are pretty well known and have a reputation for being a front for prostitution and sex trafficking. It's not uncommon to see massage parlors that are mostly or all Asian women, many of which may not be locals, could be from other parts of the country or the world that are forced to come here and work in the parlors and sell sex. But by far and away, the most common way that buyers connect with people to purchase sex is online. So things are getting away from kind of street prostitution and things are happening online, much like everything else. So there are online escort websites. People used to use the adult section of classified websites. So the adult section on Craigslist used to be a big one before they took that down. You may be familiar with Backpage, which was a huge classifieds website that was just famous for sex trafficking. Everyone knew and utilized it, as well as law enforcement and people trying to counteract sex trafficking too. But Backpage was eventually taken down. But there's still many, many other websites. There's people use dating websites, social media. There's just an endless amount of possibilities. So there are a lot of websites where anyone can go up for free and see the people who are advertised as able to be purchased for sex in Madison. It's very, very accessible if you're looking for it. So even just between a few of these sites, there are easily hundreds of ads a day in Madison. So that's not counting all of the websites. It's not even getting to any social media, which is huge. Anyone can post an ad. Anyone can respond to the ad. The ads have direct contact information for the potential buyer to reach out. And when it comes to the ads, you never really know who's on the other end of the phone number. So it could be the trafficker who's posting pictures of the person they're trafficking and kind of running the operation, or it could be the woman or the exploited person who's being forced to post their own ads. Sometimes traffickers give their victims a quota, so a certain amount of money that they need to make every day or every week. And so the women kind of run their own ads, make their own money, and then they have to like turn it into the trafficker. And maybe if they don't meet that quota, there could be like a severe punishment, whether it's a threat of violence or something else. And then of course, on these websites are also mixed in also ads that women who are prostituting are posting, so they're not actually connected to a trafficker. But all of the ads appear as if these people are independent, safe, choosing this as, you know, adult consenting prostitutes. That's what it looks like. But you never really know kind of what's behind these advertisements. So, and there are certain things that we know to look for in the ads that give us an indication that it could be a trafficking situation, which I suppose that lends us to, let's talk about kind of our response to this and how we're reaching women. So at Every Daughter, one of the primary ways that we meet women is through our direct outreach program. So the way that our outreach works is that under prayer covering, we actually go up to these websites where women are advertised for sex, and we collect information from the ads. So we take the pictures, we take down the contact information, any identifying information, and then when our whole outreach team gets together, we pray for the women, and then we use a secure, confidential phone number to directly call and text the numbers that are listed in the ads, and we try to connect with the women that way. So basically, what we say when we reach them is that we're a local outreach to women who are advertised online, that we can get them connected with services and resources in the community if they want them, and that we're basically here as a support for them wherever they're at. We also let them know to keep our number in case they need it in the future and if they meet other women who could use our support. So that's kind of the crux of how we meet women, is a direct outreach to women who are advertised online. We keep a really detailed spreadsheet of all this stuff, and so we see like the same women advertised over time. We see patterns. We're connected with law enforcement, and so if there's, you know, a girl who's advertised who looks like she's 10 or 12, we are reporting that to detectives, and they're keeping track of things too. So we're in close communication with them when there's anything that kind of feels, and because we're familiar with it now, we're familiar with some of the language that's used in the ads, and sometimes there are things that just seem really off or really obviously a trafficking situation. So we report all that stuff with law enforcement that we trust with that information. So we run that direct outreach program, but the heart and soul really of what we do at Every Daughter is that we journey alongside women in genuine relationship and friendship. So offering support that's free of judgment and reflects the unconditional love of God. So for so many exploited women, they don't have positive, supportive, loving people in their lives that are cheering them on and willing to walk with them through really hard things. Or maybe they used to have people like that in their lives, but for some reason or another, those relationships have been broken and they've kind of burned those bridges. Or they may just feel like they can't open up about what's really going on with some of the people in their lives because of all the shame that they feel. So we do work with other local organizations to connect women with services they might need. So this is pretty much anything you can think of: substance abuse treatment, mental health treatment, legal counsel, healthcare, medical attention, housing, although housing is very challenging, and basic needs stuff like food, clothing, transportation. So we really want to be there to help assist women kind of navigating through all of that and accessing resources and services that already exist in Dane County, and also just support and, you know, walk alongside them as they work on their own goals of being independent and healthy and happy and sober. A lot of women talk about just wanting kind of a quote unquote like a normal life, and so kind of getting to the point where they feel like they're stable and independent. So as important as it is for them to kind of access all those services, and that is really important, really, I think the most significant part of what we do is really just showing up, being a good listener, being compassionate and empathetic, checking in with them, helping them problem solve challenges that come up just like a friend would or a mentor, if they want us to, you know, have that role in their lives. So it's not that we are rescuing victims. That's not our point of view, but it's really instead just entering into the lives of real people and meeting them where they're at. And I guess another note on that too. So we, you know, we are a Christian organization, and we always, you know, offer prayer to people if they're interested in it, and kind of spiritual conversation and counsel, but, we're really sensitive to putting that in their court, and they can choose to do that. People aren't forced to participate in any of that if they don't want to. And it's just really important when working with exploited people and trafficked people in particular, because they have been through situations where they haven't had any choice, and it's just so critical to honor in their dignity and their choice and their freedom. And so we never kind of push that, but it's offered if people want it, and a lot of people do. So we love praying with women too. So another thing we do is what we call emergency respite. So this is where we provide very short-term kind of wraparound care for women. So that's with us covering lodging, meals, and kind of supervision and care for as much as is needed. So we right now kind of reserve our capacity for that in our funds, for women who are leaving trafficking situations and are in need of immediate safety, for women who are in transition somewhere else, so to like a treatment program or a residential recovery program. So we like know that she has a start date somewhere else and she needs somewhere safe to be in the interim. We can sometimes try to fill those gaps. Or women who just need a safe, stable setting to get away for a few days to kind of clear their head and think about their next steps. And in particular, you know, if they're, say, in an abusive or coercive relationship and life is just so chaotic, they can't even really get away to think about what they want to do. So we also have that as a possibility for them. So we don't actually have a physical house or a location where we do this. In the past, we've utilized hotels as our physical space for women to stay, but we've really gotten away from that because hotels are such a common place where the exchange of sex occurs. And so it can be either outright triggering or just like bring back a lot of bad memories. And it's really just not really a trauma-informed approach. So we've gotten away from that, but we've rented Airbnbs. We've made arrangements with particular hostels that are safe. We've gotten kind of really creative depending on the situation. But yeah, it's not something that we utilize all the time, but it is a possibility and it is an option. And just so you know, all these things I've described about what we do with Every Daughter, these are all on here. So if you grabbed one of these postcards, this describes our outreach, our respite care, and that kind of stuff. So for future reference. And then in addition to the direct work we do with women, a really important part of addressing trafficking in the community is to collaborate well with others who are doing this work. So we do that in a few ways I wanted to mention. So one is that we work closely with Project Respect. So Project Respect is a local agency that's been in the Madison community serving exploited women for a very long time, decades. They are a secular government and grant-funded organization. They've actually been highlighted by Black Hawk before through Advent Conspiracy and Love Madison, so you may be familiar. And they provide case management services for women, and they have a lot of kind of existing connections because they also, you know, get government funding. So they have kind of particular relationships with like treatment programs and health facilities where women can kind of jump to the front of the waiting list, or we're able to kind of get them in more quickly. And we work so closely with them that we're able to use all those connections and relationships that they have for our women too. So there's just a really great relationship and a lot of generosity going back and forth. So we work closely with them on problem solving issues that come up. And we make cross referrals all the time, so we enlist each other's help. Secondly, is that we participate in and are part of a large coordinated community response team in Dane County to address specifically exploitation and trafficking of children. So this group includes kind of the formal system. So law enforcement, attorneys, child protective services, youth justice, nonprofits, faith-based groups, youth-serving organizations, on and on. It's a very big group. But it's through that group that we actually started getting involved with some youth who've been trafficked, providing short-term placements for them, mentorship, being part of the child's care team. So again, don't have a ton of time to elaborate on that, but I just think it's important for you guys to know as well that there is a coordinated team that exists in Dane County. And I think it's really important for us as the faith community to be at the table and working together well with the city and the formal system to meet the needs that we're seeing. So we do not operate in isolation. We have relationships and are integrated with that team. The third way I wanted to mention is that we do collaborate with other Christian organizations. So there are others who are working on different aspects of addressing sex trafficking. Two in particular I just wanted to name because they're so important. Zateo Community is a wonderful group of believers that's working to address long-term housing, and they're planning to open a residential healing community for women in the Madison area. And secondly is Abolition Wisconsin. So this is a group of Christian men from around Madison that are gathering and launching an outreach to the sex buyers in Madison. So they're addressing the demand side of the equation. So they're actually being trained next month and getting ready to launch, which is really exciting. So if you are interested in learning more about other organizations that we're also collaborating with on sex trafficking, we do actually have a big collaborative event coming up. So on November 10th, it's a Sunday afternoon at Lighthouse Church. We're going to have a survivor speaker come. There's going to be a focus on praying together and then introduction to all these different organizations. So if you're interested in that, our website's kind of all over all these materials, everydaughter.com. There's an events tab. You can find the link there. So if you're interested in kind of learning more about all that stuff, you can talk with us after or come on the 10th. So yeah, I think that's where I'm going to pause. I have some more things we can talk about, but I'll address those when we get to the Q&A portion, depending on what you guys are interested in hearing more about. So for now, we're going to transition into an interview with one of our Black Hawk volunteers, Mason, who's also my very good friend, and for her just kind of sharing her experience from a volunteer perspective, getting involved, working with women. So, yeah, come on up.
So I'll just introduce myself too. I'm Allison Dykstra, and I'm the Impact Volunteer Coordinator here at Black Hawk. So feel free to come and talk to me afterwards if you'd like to learn about some other opportunities, but I'm going to interview Mason, who volunteers with Every Daughter. So does this sound I feel like it sounds weird. Is it good? Okay. Will you first tell us how you got connected with Every Daughter?
So, hi, I'm Mason. Like Kayla kind of alluded to, we are friends outside, like personally outside of our involvement in Every Daughter, but I feel like my day job is I'm a wedding photographer. And so Kayla used to be involved in the wedding industry a little bit, and I feel like that's how we originally met. Just found out quickly that we were both believers, and she knew that human trafficking is just something that I just feel like God's always drawing me to get more involved in. And so I feel like I was really like learning about it and like giving to it, but I wanted to like get involved, but didn't know how to do that or what that looked like. And Kayla literally was like, let's go to Starbucks one day. This was a couple years ago, and told me that she was starting this organization here in Madison. She had been involved in a similar organization in Chicago. And she just said like, do you want to get involved? And I was like, yes, oh my gosh, totally. So I feel like I've been involved since the very start. So
that's great.
Yeah, it's been awesome.
So can you tell us a little bit about what your role looks like and what you do with Every Daughter?
Yeah, so I feel like Kayla touched kind of on all the different aspects of Every Daughter. But first and foremost, I feel like I'm on the prayer corps, which is a huge part of Every Daughter. We just really believe, yeah, like without God, we can't do this and don't want to be doing this. And so I feel like prayer is totally like the foundation of what we do. And so being in the prayer corps, I pray once a week. I pray on Thursdays today for the women that we're working with. Their needs, women in the community that are brought to our attention, things like that. So, and then I'm also on the outreach team. So kind of like Kayla touched on, doing direct outreach to women, calling ads, and meeting with the women when like they want it or it's appropriate. So
your time, can you just describe a little bit about what your time looks like? So you have Thursday is your day that you pray, and then what might your other time there look like?
Totally. So, Thursdays we, or like for the prayer corps, we get an email every week that just kind of gives updates on all the women that we're walking alongside, what's going on in their lives, prayer requests, things like that. And so, just praying through those things on my own time, obviously. And also that day, it's cool. Directors or people who are meeting with women, if there's something going on a Thursday, like we also get a text that's just like, hey, so-and-so is going to coffee with this person. Like, can you pray it too? Little things like that, which is cool. So otherwise, yeah, we meet once a month to do direct outreach, calling the ads. I feel like you kind of touched on this, but pray for the women, pray over the ads. The director who picks the ads, like, it's a very prayerful experience. And then, yeah, we take turns calling the women while everyone's praying. We call on speakerphone so everyone can hear the call. And it's just helpful. I feel like a thing when I didn't know what I was doing and I started, you know, it can be nerve-wracking. But I feel like people like Kayla, who I always say, like, she knows the lingo. Like, she's like a social worker, so she sounds really smart. And she is really smart. You don't just sound smart. But I feel like, you know, you could be explaining something to a woman who has a question and she can kind of like give you the word you need or whatever. So, yes, we call the women. I feel like something I would want to say though is, really just totally, it can be scary, I feel like, or nerve-wracking, but you're just like letting God speak through you. And it's not about you. Like, it's easy to make it about us and I have to say the perfect thing, but I feel like the Holy Spirit has like gone before us and is like guiding the conversation. And really, like, you are just wanting to talk to this person who is telling you that they want help as if you're like sitting across from them. What would you do? What would you say? And so I feel like it's really not as intimidating as it seems. And of course, like, the more you do it, you get more comfortable. So then we pray when the call ends. I mean, a lot of times we don't talk to people because they don't pick up. So then we'll text them. And a lot of it's through texting, how we communicate even now with each other. And then I can talk about the meeting with women too, but I don't know. That looks so different depending on the person. So,
well, maybe let's, okay. Yeah, we'll see. So you talked about being nervous or scared for those phone calls. Did you have any other, kind of before you started, any initial fears or concerns?
Yes, definitely. So I feel like, just kind of touching back on the call quick, I definitely think going into getting involved, like safety was just like a big thing that I was like fearful about. Like you touched on totally, like we have these thoughts of what it's going to look like and what people are like. And I just think it can feel like scary and unknown. And so I just want to preface by saying that like now that I've been doing this for a few years, I never is a totally wrong word to say. I rarely feel scared anymore. It's not scary. And so I would just want to like put that out there. But you know, Kayla and the other directors, these people like know what they're talking about and know what they're doing. And so there's tons of protocol in place to address safety concerns. Things like calling with, we all have unknown like numbers that we call with. So we're not calling with our personal cell phones. When we're meeting with women, especially in the beginning, we're always going in groups of two. There's tons of training involved to even do direct outreach with women. And so I feel like, I was really fearful, but now that I'm doing it, it's not scary. So, but it's okay that it feels scary. That's like totally normal. I just want to say that. So, the other biggest like thing that I would say that I felt going into it was I felt super drawn to getting involved. Like I said, like getting my hands and feet dirty. Just like my background, super, super briefly, I feel like I come from a very, like, quote unquote, normal, like, Caucasian family, middle class, like, super normal upbringing. Totally comfortable to share this. Like, I know this is pretty rare, but like, I've never been sexually abused, anything like that. And so I felt like going into it, like, I literally could never relate to these women. Like, I am so different from them. They're going to look at me and be like, yeah, no. Like, I'm never going to tell you anything. You're so different. Like, I was so scared of that. And I feel like I can just sum up the, like, okay. I just want to share one experience that I feel like will address that fear. So this was, like, a year ago, a woman that I've gotten to know super, super well. I would consider her a friend now. We met her through directly calling an ad. She posted on Facebook like a year ago after we had known each other for maybe about a year, a photo of us together after we had gone out for celebrating like 100 days sober or something like that, went out to dinner. And she posted a selfie of us and she literally wrote, this woman and I, we could not come from more different places, but she's never judged me. She's only loved me. So, so grateful for her. And I just feel like God literally used a woman to like extinguish any fear that I had about being so different. Just like we all want, like these women just want to be seen and loved. Like that's what we're all wanting and just have someone show up for them and be a friend. And so I feel like that proved to me it didn't matter. And I mean, I've experienced that in a lot of ways, but that was so cool. Like Holy Spirit, direct answer to that, like fear. So yeah. Okay.
I think a lot of these things sort of overlay and touch on each other, but is there anything else that you have learned or the women that you work with have taught you or just the experience of being with every daughter that you've learned?
Yeah. I just feel like
I think when we were talking, and maybe you have something else, but the no judging, I think was huge for me. I don't know if that's something that you
totally
had learned. I mean, I know you would go into it knowing not to judge. Yes. But, so I don't.
Yeah. I think just like being open-minded, it's like a similar idea, but, it's going to like look so different than you think, as I'm kind of already sharing. Walking alongside these women and getting involved in this world. And I feel like Kayla's kind of saying that their lives are really like chaotic and unpredictable. And so I just feel like being flexible and being open-minded, which has been so good for me. I'm like totally a control freak and like type A personality. So it's been a really awesome, like growing opportunity. And I just feel like, I don't know, going on the judgment thing, right? Like the more you just get to know someone, you like literally could never, I feel like I could never judge them now because yeah, their stories. So anyway.
Do you have any advice or encouragement for people who might be wanting to take the next step or might want to get involved?
Just say, like, just do it. That's obviously like a dumb thing to say, but I feel like getting involved is going to look super different for everyone. Not everyone's meant to like maybe work directly with the women, but you can be involved in other ways. So I feel like if you feel drawn to it, just do it, just try it. I mean, I feel like I address everything, like the fears and all that. Like, I feel like God will really surprise you and grow you in it. It's super awesome. So
okay. Great. Thank you so much. I'm going to have ask Kayla to come back up and she'll describe some of the opportunities.
Thanks very much.
I'll give you one of them. It doesn't matter. Okay, cool. Thanks. So if you grabbed, so there's a sheet over there too, lots of sheets. This one says volunteer opportunities. So just super briefly, everything's on here so you can read it. But we have three main volunteer teams. The first is Prayer Corps. Mason mentioned this. So that's committing to pray on one designated day per week. Our director of prayer and operations, Paula Doty, is wonderful. And she sends out beautiful emails every week with a lot of detail about the women we're working with and really specific prayer requests and updates. And then it's also, so it's praying on your designated day of the week, being kind of on call for urgent or real-time prayer needs. These situations are often kind of quickly moving. So if we have kind of a crisis, it's all kind of coming about maybe in a day. And so there's things that you're kind of not getting in the weekly emails that you'll get texts about. And then we do have quarterly prayer meetings that we like our prayer corps to be at. So even just for the prayer corps, there's an application process and interviews because obviously the confidentiality of the women is really significant to us. So making sure that the people we have in the prayer corps are trustworthy and are committing to praying and to confidentiality is an important thing. So the outreach team, so you need to be on the prayer corps for at least 3 months before doing outreach. But essentially that is, you've heard us talk a lot about it, but participating in the phone outreach. And then our outreach team are the people who do all of the direct work with women. So all of the walking alongside and the friendship, shopping, going to appointments, checking in, having coffee, just being a friend. So that's all part of the outreach team. And recently we implemented, the outreach team is going to be getting together every month to just get to know one another. So as we come around women and love them, we also want to know each other deeply and well and have close relationship with each other. And then we also have our emergency care team. So I should mention Prayer Corps and Outreach Team are women only. Emergency care could be anyone. And so that's really just, we kind of have a list of people that are willing to be called or emailed or texted when we're doing that emergency respite care. So when we're doing the short-term wraparound care of women, it takes a lot of people to make that happen. A lot of meals, a lot of transportation. So it's really helpful to have a list of people who are willing to be contacted. And there's no commitment as part of that. If you only kind of participate as you're willing. But that's one kind of easy way to participate as you're able. And then I also mentioned on the bottom here of this sheet. So there's a lot of other ways if you are not wanting to volunteer directly that you can do to help. So all of the money that we have is donated directly. So or by people hosting fundraisers. So we have people who donate directly. We've had people do a lot of really creative things like youth groups who've hosted events with, you know, to create awareness and have the proceeds come to somewhere directly. So that's great. We also, when we first meet women, we give them a gift bag. And so if you're interested in sponsoring a gift bag or sometimes like life groups and small groups, that's something they can do. So we can get you kind of a shopping list and you can put something together and we'll help you with that, or you can sponsor it. And then also spreading the word. Like, awareness actually is a really critical step. And so we are available and love coming to different events, even things like kind of private parties at people's houses if they want to gather. They feel like they have a lot of people in their life who would be interested. We're happy to do something like that. We do conferences, presentations, and people have been really creative about kind of thinking through what's their sphere of influence in their life And is there any way to kind of incorporate education through what they do? So that's just a list of some kind of beginning things to talk about for volunteer opportunities. And I think that's it. We'll have time at the end if you're interested in getting involved in any of this stuff. I will mention, too, even something as simple as being on our email list. So we send out an email update every quarter. So it's just one email every 3 months, but we kind of give an overview of what's going on and highlight some kind of specific women's stories in a way that still maintains their confidentiality. So feel free to ask us more questions later on, but I think Mason's gonna come back up and we're gonna take some questions if you have them, so. Does anyone have a question? Yeah.
The traffickers themselves, I'm trying to imagine what's going on, what they're telling themselves to have. I mean, I guess maybe they sort of say, oh yeah, you know, like good evil people do evil things, but I'm sure it's more complicated than that. What is that?
Yeah. So a few points that come to mind. One is that sex trafficking is very lucrative. It just makes a lot of money. So I think it's only second to drug trafficking. And one thing that they liken it to is, like, if you have a drug dealer who's selling product, they need to, when they sell drugs, they need to get more and then they sell them. The difference with sex trafficking is when you have a victim, you can sell that person again and again and again, day after day after day. And so particularly when you have traffickers who are controlling many women, they kind of exponentially increase the money that they make. So there is a lot of money in it. That's just kind of a straight fact. But also, I just think in general, and this goes, I think, for the traffickers and the sex buyers, is that they're, you know, the more that you get to know people and you hear people's stories, you realize the situations they've come from and the distortions that they've grown up with that can come from things like being sexually abused themselves as children. So that's a really significant and common thing for sex buyers, is to have had a distorted sexuality growing up, and that kind of being over time kind of morphing into what becomes, using and exploiting other people. So, yeah, I mean, I think people can, you know, you also hear people who just kind of grew up around it. So, I mean, I particularly personally experienced this when I worked in social work in Chicago and had, you know, women who were like third generation prostituting. It's what their mom did. It's what their grandma did. It's all they've ever known. And I think there are sometimes similar dynamics for traffickers too. So who maybe grow up with family members who are traffickers. And then there's just kind of the whole like pimp culture, which is a real thing, being really glorified. And so that's all I got on that. Yeah, go ahead. Want me to spark your memory?
I literally have like the worst memory of all time. So okay,
she can elaborate. We definitely have. So there's a couple things. So one is that part of the reason that we have people be on prayer corps initially for a period of time before doing outreach is they're getting these emails every single week with lots of details about the women's lives and about how we work with them, how we interact with them, and so you're kind of building your knowledge about the real world. Lives of the women and what our approach is in working with them as you're even just on prayer corps, taking that information and praying over it. So that's really important for us, for people to have that experience. We do practical training around the calling. So we have like a script that we call from essentially, which has been kind of honed over the last few years to be something where like really happy with the way it looks now and is really conversational. So we do like practice scenarios with all sorts of, you know, what if a man answers the phone? Like, oh, what do we do there? So we think through all those things. And then I think, and you can speak to this, Mason, I really think probably the most significant like training is really hands-on stuff. So the way that we
really design it and intend it to work is that myself or the other director, Paula, like if Mason was meeting with a woman for the first time, it would be either Paula and I and one of our other volunteers, so that you're with one of the directors for those initial contacts. And so as you just get to know women and you're starting to meet with them, that you're with someone who's experienced. And if you like freeze up in the moment and don't have anything to say, it's okay. You know, there's someone else there to back you up. So, and I do think it's also just very much like a team effort. So like when Mason started meeting with women, we used to talk like all the time, even about like text conversations, like, oh, this is what she texts me. What should I text back? You know? And so we're like brainstorming together. Like it's very much feels like a team effort that we're all in it together and really thinking through, you know, cause as you can imagine, there's a lot of things that come up with like boundary issues and, just really complex situations that we're thinking through, yeah, and so we're always just kind of in it together.
So. I was going to say, too, at the prayer meetings, yeah. I don't know how often those are happening now, yeah. Either probably every quarter now,
yeah.
But it's like a huge time of prayer, but then there's also always a training about some topic of like trauma in childhood and then how that affects, mm-hmm. you know, or what is this one that you say, why doesn't she leave the power of coercion? Totally had a training on this, like to, you know, think about.
Yeah. Yep. So we had been, since we started, we've been doing quarterly events where we touch on different subjects. So we've done like substance abuse. We did a whole year on different aspects of trauma.
And I feel like those are like strongly encouraged that you come if you're on the prayer corps. Like obviously if you have something like that day, you can't go, of course, but like really like we want you to be there. It's for your own benefit too. But I was going to say for sure, like just going like your first couple times, like you go with someone who's more experienced and just like sit and watch, like not watch, that's so wrong to say, like be there and just like listen and smile. And you know, that's how you just see. Mm-hmm. And then it's like, oh, you're just like interacting with another human.
Yeah.
So I don't know, did that help? Okay. Thank you, Kayla.
Yeah, great question. So our outreach meetings are held in people's homes. So our outreach team is small enough to fit in a home. So yeah, we would usually meet at one particular director's home. She's in between homes, so she went away and, you know, I'm over there. So, yeah, we meet in people's homes to do, and that's the kind of the beauty of the phone outreach is, like, we just need a phone. And to answer that more specifically, we use Google Voice numbers. I don't know if people are familiar with those, but it's a free app from Google that gives you a free confidential number that's not connected to your personal information. So our whole outreach team has the app. So we each have a unique Google Voice number that's not our phone number.
And that's how we like connect with women, mm-hmm. even like long-term numbers. Relationships. Like
yeah. still, that's and we make sure none of our personal info is connected to those numbers. But yeah, so we meet in homes. The big quarterly events, we rotate between churches. So we've had a few at Black Hawk. We've gone to several different churches because our ministry is made up of people from lots of different churches around Madison. So it's really fun to be at different churches. Yeah. Oh, and meetings with women. Maybe are you interested about that? Those happen usually in like coffee shops,
restaurants,
always. Taking a walk. Yeah. You take women to appointments. When we know women well enough, we sometimes like pick them up where they're living. And again, we've kind of, the benefit of us having so much flexibility is that we're able to do kind of whatever our capacity allows. So like with one woman, there's a period of time where she had a great job, but she couldn't, like her shift ended so late, she couldn't take a bus. And so for a few weeks, our outreach team like took her home from her shift that ended at like 11 at night, every shift that she had for a few weeks. But we had the people and we were able to do it and we knew her well and we trusted her and
she'd been clean for a long time.
Yeah. She wasn't involved with like a person who was, you know, violent or dangerous. We're like think really hard about those situations. But yeah, so the meetings with the women are out wherever. We don't do those in our home though. We keep them in a public place. So yeah. Yeah. So we've reached online,
don't want to get this figure wrong, but I know it's like at least over 50, maybe close to 300. But women we've directly worked with, so I would say at any given time, we're probably actively working with like 5-6 women at a time, and it kind of just ebbs and flows. You know, some, like, in fact, so there's a woman we worked closely with and was like really intense. We did a lot with, this is actually the first woman that Mason got really involved with. Lot going on for her, and lot of crisis stuff. And we had last seen her last October. And so she just kind of fell off and we stopped hearing from her. And she randomly out of the blue called both Mason and I a week ago and said, hey, I found an old phone and I found your number in it. And we just got lunch with her on Sunday. So, yeah, so I imagine we'll be back in her life now. So, and she's doing well, which is awesome. But yeah, so it just ebbs and flows. Sometimes people are, out of the picture. And we also, I didn't mention this, but we also get referrals from other places. So like Project Respect, our sister team in Chicago that our outreach is modeled after, you know, they have women that maybe were advertised in Chicago and they reached out to, but they actually live somewhere in southern Wisconsin. So we'll get involved with them, and that might be maybe just one meeting and a referral for services or something. I don't know exactly, but yeah, rough idea.
It's a different context, but in traveling at the airport, you always see a sign about where the sex trafficking sees something. How do you know? How do you give a hint?
You don't really. I mean, I don't know. I mean, there's like plenty of lists that they put out of like signs that you can look for. I will say this, the child sex trafficking handout I gave you, that actually does have like the physical indicators. There's a list of like, I don't know, 15 on here that would be helpful to look at. And they always say things like, you know, if someone, if it's an adult who doesn't seem to be related to the child and the person's looking down, they don't know where they are, they don't have identification. Typically you're not going to necessarily see something out in public that, I mean, I think the right answer is if you're ever concerned, you should call the National Human Trafficking Hotline, which I included on there. But I'll just say it's very challenging to see something in public and report when it like looks like something might be off. If you have an opportunity, like we've heard sometimes people have an opportunity to like privately talk to the person that they think might be in danger and say like, hey, are you okay? What's going on? Slip them like the human trafficking number they can call. But typically it's just really hard because again, most times, well, I actually didn't get into this, but most times trafficking victims don't actually view themselves as victims. So they think that they have kind of chosen into it. And it is again, looks more like a domestic violence relationship. So they view it more as like a boyfriend situation, not all the time, but many times. And so if you have just someone out of the blue kind of intervening, many times the person being trafficked probably wouldn't even respond to law enforcement. They would say they're fine. So, you can take a look at the indicators. And if you're ever concerned, Polaris that runs the human trafficking hotline, they have a great website too. So you can look for some of those things. But, it's hard to know. Yep, some do, some don't. Yep, but there are a number of women that we know and are walking with long term who've been out of the life for a long time, that are sober and stable and healthy, and it's really beautiful. And if anything, really what we see with those long term people is the real need is for people. It's for community. So people can get sober, they can get housing, they can have a job, but if they don't have people to share life with, it's lonely and it's sad. And our little outreach team can only do so much. We can't be like community for everybody. And so we are actually kind of brainstorming around different ways that the bigger church can maybe help in that way and be little communities for women. But that's cutting edge.
Just drop
it. Don't let that out of the bag. But yeah, just brainstorming about like how can we involve more people, because everybody needs, like, people need people. You guys know that. And so that really is the biggest need. And certainly there's a lot of steps in between, but Yeah, so women do lead. That's great. Yeah. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so Project Respect that I mentioned, so they run a peer support group out of their location on the east side, downtown-ish on Johnson Street. So they run a weekly support group that's run by peers, and there's a peer mentor there that we have worked closely with and is starting to actually speak publicly. So that's a great resource, just being with other women who really understand, the complexities of the life and... Yeah, and then, of course, there's other groups if women have, to specifically address addiction or, mental health outpatient groups. There's other sorts of things, but particularly for women in sex trafficking and prostitution, Project Respect runs groups, which are great. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah, so I would say if there is that situation, you could go to our website and there's a form, and one of the boxes says like referring a woman. So we get that email immediately and we'll be in contact. We're just because the nature of the way that our outreach is run and how small our outreach team is, and because we're so like relationally intensive in the way we're involved with women, we don't have the capacity to like share our number widely and like put it on a flyer and not a bulletin board or something. But if there's a particular situation, we do take referrals, and you can do that through our website. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What about the traffickers? I mean, with your organization and some of the other organizations, is there a threat? I mean, you're a threat to them.
Yeah, you know, you'd think so, but they don't seem to care. I don't know. I think that they, this is something I really asked a lot about when I was down in Chicago and, thinking about starting it here, because you'd think, like, wouldn't they, like, want to come after us? Or, I don't know. I think they, just think we're, like, crazy church ladies or whatever. And when we call and, just the way that we present ourselves, we do it in a really non-threatening manner. Like, we're not calling saying, we're here to rescue you from your sex trafficker. We're like, hey, we just want to get connected with, you with support. If you're having a hard time paying your bills, we help talk about that, give information on a food pantry, whatever. So, and I think, I think maybe they're just operating in their own world. And, we've never had an issue. Chicago's been going for almost 10 years. They've never had a problem. So, no, just doesn't, so far, thank you, Lord. Doesn't seem to be an issue. So, yeah. What creates demand? So people who are interested in purchasing other people for sex creates demand. I'm sure if you're interested enough to come to this training, you probably know, even the connection between pornography and purchasing people. So, just in, kind of compulsive or excessive pornography use, they're just at a certain level that just doesn't, get the job done anymore. And then people transition to, wanting to purchase people. So definitely demand is such a critical part of this. This would not exist without demand. And so, the group I mentioned, Abolition Wisconsin, the group of men who are addressing demand, were just so thrilled about what they're doing, and also from a place of compassion and love and God's love for people, want to reach the men. And again, there are women sex buyers, but by far and away, it's men. And really, also offering them love and support and a way to get healing and address the wounds that create such a distortion without judgment. Yeah. So, Yes. Yeah. You mean in trafficking generally or with our particular cases? Yeah. So we really leave, the choice. In as much as possible, we leave the choice for law enforcement involvement up to the women. So there's a lot of reasons why there is distrust of the system and of law enforcement, and we have to respect that. And so, in fact, we've had a number of women, when we're calling and texting, saying, are you with the police? You know, they won't talk to us if they think that we're with the police. So, there have been a couple situations where we have involved law enforcement. Like I mentioned with the ads, when we see things that are especially sketchy, we send them over. But then also, we did have a situation once where a woman from our sister team in Chicago was... They had met her and actually been walking in relationship with her for about a year, and she ended up kind of being with her trafficker in a city in southern Wisconsin. And this trafficker was super dangerous, trafficked drugs, weapons, extremely controlling, introduced her to heroin to control her. And we ended up working with law enforcement and the Department of Justice Anti-Trafficking Task Force. We've worked with the FBI on a different case before. So it just depends on the particulars. If there's, like, knowing that that woman, and she was reaching out and saying, like, she was really in danger and really needing help. And she was, you know, eventually willing to work with law enforcement. So we brought them in to locate her and provide security for us as we were trying to set up a time to meet her. So we have utilized them when there's, like, a legitimate safety issue. Yeah, or when, like, the one situation I mentioned with the FBI, there was, like, law enforcement had contacted Project Respect, actually saying, we're going to do a raid. We know there's a trafficking ring. We're going to raid this motel. We're expecting to recover victims. Are you able to care for them? So we ended up, you know, caring for a woman for probably 5 days over a weekend until, and English was not her first language. She hardly knew any English. And so until the correct kind of interpreter from the FBI could meet with her the next week, we cared for her. So law enforcement was very involved in that situation. So it just depends on the dynamics. Mm-hmm.
So these women, they have children, they have still
yes.
Have children
involved. Yes. So that's actually been something very interesting that I didn't expect. I knew my background in child protection would be helpful, but I didn't know how critical it would be. Pretty much all of the women, most of the women we know have children, and almost all of them have either had child protection cases open at one point, maybe either lost their children permanently, they're openly involved with child protection, or they've had open cases and investigations while we've been involved. It's definitely a very real issue. And because of all of the danger that comes along with the lifestyle, that can put children at risk. Very much a factor. But we work with a number of women that also are actively involved with their children currently, too.
Like getting women out of the life, if that's what they're providing for their kids, to threaten kids.
Oh, is that what you meant? That
we
if.
Also asked that.
Oh, you did.
Does it, like, threaten the children if the woman is helped by us, in a way?
Oh.
I would say we haven't ever had that experience.
Haven't had that come up.
Yeah.
And I will say one more plug for Zateo Community that's opening the long-term healing community. That's actually going to be for women and their children, which is actually very unique. So there's a lot of programs that take just adult women, very few that take women and their children. So that is going to be a huge resource when we have it locally, which we're very excited about. So, yeah. Anyone else? I know we're probably at time, aren't we, Susan? We'll be around, too.
Thank you. Great job, both of you. Thank you so much. We're going to transition now. We're going to be closing out here shortly, but we have a little window of time before we actually hit 8, when we promise to end, where you can come and talk to both of them. We tried to really have that Q&A open for a while because we figured a lot of people would have similar questions, so it felt right to do that. We do want to leave you a little bit of space. So Mason, would you mind going to the back table? Would you mind staying up at the front table?
Yep.
And then you can kind of pick who to talk to, and both can help you with different opportunities to sign up or another question maybe that didn't get answered or something like that. And so again, thanks for coming. Really appreciate seeing all your faces, and I hope this was a good use of your time tonight. it seems like it was. So thank you, Jesus, and thank you, Kayla and Mason. So get in line and talk to them.